the headlines, Iran slams the U.S. for making contradictory comments regarding negotiations of the 2015 deal. Israel's violence against Palestinians continues unabated, killing another Palestinian in East al-Quds. And tens of thousands of people take to the streets in Germany to protest against the growing living cost. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran has condemned what it calls contradictory comments by U.S. officials regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says American authorities continue to exchange messages with Tehran, while at the same time they are fanning the flames of anti-government riots in Iran. The top diplomat argues that U.S. officials are seeking to exert political pressure in an effort to win concessions during negotiations. The comments were in an apparent response to the statements of the U.S. authorities, who have announced that the JCPOA revival negotiations are no longer on Washington's agenda. Amir Abdollahian rejects this and says that the priority for Americans is to reach an agreement, and they want that as soon as possible. The foreign minister stressed that Tehran will move within the framework of an agreement in which its red lines are respected. He added, however, that Tehran will not leave the negotiating table. We asked peace activist Daniel Kovalik about the United States' ultimate plan by pursuing a double standard policy towards Iran, and here's what he had to say.
Well, look, I would like to see the deal entered into again by the U.S., but I'll be honest, I don't predict that it will be. For the reason you say, the U.S. does not want deals with Iran. It wants regime change. And honestly, I think it's just going to continue to play games with Iran over the nuclear deal and other issues and do everything it can to overthrow the government. So where is the incentive for Iran to negotiate here under those circumstances? I don't see it.
President Ibrahim Raisi says Iran is determined to win the sanctions war imposed by the U.S. and other adversaries, citing 13% growth in non-oil exports this year. Raisi says that those who have enforced sanctions against Iran aims to prevent the country from achieving any growth or producing or exporting anything. He says the U.S. Treasury Department has created numerous obstacles for Iranian exporters around the globe as enemies want Iran to be a mere consumer. But Raisi stressed that Iranian manufacturers and businessmen are determined to promote exports now that demand is rising for quality Iranian-made products, including military hardware. He says that this has angered Iran's enemies, who do not want the country to grow and capture the markets. Israel's bloody violence against Palestinians shows no sign of abating. The regime forces have killed yet another Palestinian in occupied al-Quds. The 32-year-old victim was shot dead in the neighborhood. Tensions have intensified in occupied territories following an uptick in Israeli crackdown against Palestinians and near daily raids in the occupied West Bank. According to the United Nations, more than 115 Palestinians have been killed this year in the occupied West Bank alone, the heaviest toll in nearly 7 years. In Germany, tens of thousands of people took to the streets to demand for more distribution of government funds in face of unprecedented energy prices. Let's take a listen. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, in Germany, tens of thousands of protesters have gathered to demand a more just distribution of government funds to deal with the rising energy prices and living costs. The protests were held in six major cities, including the capital, Berlin. Protesters held signs bearing slogans calling for lowering inflation and more energy price subsidies for the poor. That after Parliament approved the government's 200 billion euro rescue package, which aims to protect companies and households from the impact of soaring energy prices. Some protesters are calling for a faster transition from fossil fuels and switching off nuclear power. And the German inflation in September hit its highest level in more than a quarter of a century at nearly 11%, driven up by higher energy costs. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's joining us live from Brussels. And also, we have Paul Sheldon Foote, professor at the California State University, joining us live from California. Now, let's begin with our correspondent, Jerome. If you could please tell us more about the situation right now in Germany, give us an update about these protests that are taking place. What exactly do these people want, and is the government willing to meet their demands?
Well, I think we can speak very generally about the protests in Germany, because there's no doubt about it. You could forecast that we're going to see many more of these protests, not just in Germany, but right across the European Union as the winter sets in. I think we're going to see unprecedented level and in terms of numbers attending these protests, because it's in Germany, but it's right across the block where you have a situation. People feel a great deal of fatigue in terms of all of the money that's being pumped into Ukraine. And at the same time, ordinary citizens here are really on their knees. They're begging for more help. I mean, the situation is crazy. It's not just a situation like, you know, energy bills have increased by 50 euro. If you consider that, for example, a small business that might have been paying 300 euro a month for electricity this time last year, now it's over 1,000 euro. So we're talking about a huge number of businesses, small, medium-sized, even large corporations, who actually might not be able to survive this situation in terms of the energy costs. And all the while we hear about, you know, so far this year, 19 billion euro has been pumped into the Ukrainian government by the European Union. EU leaders have agreed to pump in at least 18 billion next year. That's just to prop up the government. That's got nothing to do with the huge amounts of weapons. I mean, the price in terms of arming Ukraine, the Ukrainian army, it's much, much more than that. I mean, so these figures are tiny compared to the sort of military end of things. And at the same time, the EU is pumping huge amounts of money into the United States. The US is charging top dollar for its liquefied natural gas. And, you know, even within EU leaders are getting upset with the United States that we're being charged so much, when before all of this happened, we were getting cheap gas piped in directly from Russia. And it's ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Rents are going up because landlords who have mortgages, they're passing on the rising interest rates. They're passing those on to tenants. So rents are going up. People, ordinary households who have mortgages, their mortgages are going up. So we have a situation. Businesses are really on the brink. Many businesses are closing down. Households, many people are at risk of losing their homes because of the interest rates are going up. Inflation continues to rocket. I mean, we talk about 10% on average across the Eurozone, but in some countries it's much higher. And in real terms, when you consider interest rates that keep going up and will keep going up, I mean, this is a really catastrophic situation. And, you know, as many people have said it, sort of more level-headed people have said it, this could have been avoided. It was either provoked, or it could have been avoided if EU leaders, if Western leaders had have listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns, stopped using NATO to push against Russia. It's not to say that Russia is the angel in all of this, or is innocent, or it's not being pro-Russian to say it. It's a case of talking about the fact that this situation could have been somehow avoided if the actual diplomacy had have worked. But for some reason, and there are many ideas behind it, there are many people, particularly in Washington, who did not want diplomacy to work. So we're seeing the United States getting very rich on this energy situation, the arms industry in the United States getting hugely rich. So you have to ask, who's pulling the strings behind all of this?
So, Mr. Sheldon, we just heard our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, explaining how the situation is becoming worse for ordinary people. Well, not only in Germany, but also elsewhere in Europe, mainly because of the war in Ukraine. And, of course, now that the Europeans have decided to go down that path, particularly in Germany, is there any way for the government to alleviate the disastrous consequences of that for its ordinary people, at least in businesses, especially small and medium-sized businesses, as Jerome explained, who will not be able to survive the situation?
Well, as your correspondent explained very well and suggested, one way is to quit pouring money into Ukraine. But his arguments were fantastic. The problem is that the people who really feel the pain and want to demonstrate aren't going to want to be on the streets with Greenpeace and these other weird people who are out today demonstrating. Greenpeace claims to have 580,000 members in Germany, and that 24,000 people supposedly showed up at the protest. The problem is that any honest person who wants to protest wouldn't want to be in the same street with these people. They are saying switch off nuclear power, transition faster from fossil fuels, phase out coal, at a time when they are in desperate need of energy from all sources. They cannot be more insane than the Greenpeace people. And so your correspondent is right. There will be many more protests, but fortunately, they'll be led by people who are expressing his views and not those of Greenpeace.
So, Mr. Sheldon, do you see any way out of the situation for particularly the German government?
The problem with what these folks are demanding is who's paying for it. Do you pay for it in the way of inflation? Do you pass it on to future generations? I'm sure that the politicians will dream up some little moves, but the Germans should be a little bit smarter in who they vote for. Just look to their neighbors in Italy. You had a major change in government in Italy, and you need other changes throughout Europe where you have nationalists coming in and saying, we've had enough of the Zionist agenda. We're not going to be part of this. We're not going to be the globalists. We want people who represent our interests and not the interests of some warmongering elite.
Thank you very much, Paul Sheldon, Foote, professor at California State University, and also Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, joining us live from Brussels. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Italy's first female Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, and her cabinet have been sworn in by President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni is tasked with steering the country out of an economic storm that risks damaging family livelihoods long term. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
On Saturday, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni took an oath as Italy's Prime Minister before President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni, the country's first woman to become premier, is one of the founders and the current leader of the far-right-leaning party Brothers of Italy, the political force that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in last month's general election. Besides bringing some political stability to Italy, which has seen 68 governments in its 74 years of history as a republic, Meloni will have to face a series of daunting challenges, including a looming recession, protecting Italians from surging energy bills, and reassuring the establishment about her Atlanticist and anti-Putin alignment.
Delegates from our coalition met with President Mattarella, and they agreed over the fact that there are many emergencies at national and international level, and quick answers are needed.
Italy's new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, says her government will follow the line of NATO and the Western Alliance. Also, the new Foreign Minister, former European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, has repeatedly said he will be fully supportive of Kyiv. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, are long-time admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier this week, a video portraying Berlusconi saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine caused a stir in the political arena. Italians are hoping the new government will work for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine.
We must do all we can to stop the war through negotiations and dialogue, and the new government must help Italians to pay energy bills. We are on our knees.
We are confident that the new government will do good. Its biggest challenge will be easing the impact of soaring energy bills on Italians.
Meloni is expected to lay out her political priorities next week when she faces confidence votes at the parliament that will confirm or not that she holds a majority. Max Civili, Rome.
Kiev says Russian strikes on energy facilities have caused massive blackouts across Ukraine. The Ukrainian presidency says more than 1 million households are left without electricity. More than 670,000 of them are in the western region of Khmelnytskyi alone. According to Ukraine's energy minister, Russian air attacks have hit at least half of Ukraine's thermal generation capacity since October 10th. As much as 40% of the country's energy infrastructure has been seriously damaged. The chief of Ukraine's national energy operator says some parts of the country are reducing their electricity use by up to 20%. Energy authorities believe the voluntary measures are not enough for the regions where the infrastructure has suffered the most damage. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A dark, cold winter awaits Britain with the strikes and chaos in major city centres as the new Prime Minister Liz Truss is unable to rein in the economic crisis. Even experts have warned that Truss is about to collapse under the dead weights of the British economy. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, while Liz Truss is the architect of her own troubles in the UK right now, it is the financial markets that possess the mechanisms which will ultimately bring her down. When they saw that the economic stability which they carve and on which their profits depend was threatened by her pre-posterior policies, they acted to protect themselves, if that meant possibly bringing down an outspoken devotee of free market capitalism, then so be it. Capitalism doesn't care about the sovereignty of any state. It doesn't care about individuals, their intentions or philosophies, or even the well-being of millions of people who are hopelessly dependent on their nation's economy. In the great capitalist schemes of things, capitalism doesn't care about any of that beyond the simple extent to which these things can serve capitalism. Truss, in office barely 6 weeks, has caused a period of financial tumult with a controversial mini-budget which included unfunded tax cuts, undermining confidence in her government and the UK's currency. Last week, she sacrificed her chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, in office for barely 38 days. She sacked him for implementing the very fiscal measures central to her economic strategy. She also reversed several key measures that were fundamental to that strategy. Why? Because the markets told her to. The market's response to the mini-budget caused sterling to nosedive, pension funds to panic, banks to high mortgage interest rates for millions of householders, and the Bank of England to pour in tens of billions of pounds worth of support. Truss responded by dumping Kwarteng and promising to retain a scheduled rise in corporation tax, which she had previously said she would scrap. To further steady investors' nerves, she also scrapped plans to abolish the UK's 45% higher tax rate, and she is proposing an increased tax take from energy companies, which sounds very like backtracking on a pledge she made to not introduce a windfall tax. Why? Because the markets told her to. Truss was forced to dismantle her radical plans. This is because the markets exerted their influence. They have forced significant U-turns and even cost a chancellor his job. Will it stop there, or will they also force a prime minister out of office? Unlike Margaret Thatcher, who famously declared herself a lady not for turning and on whom Truss rather embarrassingly styles herself, the current UK prime minister appears to be very much a lady for turning. Truss was prepared to cancel her government's economic plans just to appease the money markets. The financiers are back in control. Some might argue that a readiness to acknowledge one's errors is a measure of strength in anyone, especially a national leader. Some might argue that it shows that the interests of the country are that leader's central focus. But with Truss, this is more than outweighed by her stubborn refusal at the outset to listen to voices of caution before the measures were announced and implemented, even to the point of admitting the potential, even the certainty, for catastrophic damage and claiming it was a necessary collateral for policy to succeed. Yes, self-awareness and humility in a leader and the capacity to change course can be a great strength, but not if that is happening all the time. In Truss's case, it has happened continually in what should have been the honeymoon period of her premiership, in which she could have been given the opportunity to prove herself. Now, she has been backed into a corner and her only course of action is submission. The new Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has already admitted that, contrary to Truss's original promises, there will be spending cuts to public services and tax rises. He has also declined to say whether he will honor Truss's pledges to increase defense spending to 3% of GDP and cut the basic rate of income tax for millions of people. He's doing what he thinks the markets want to hear and encourage confidence. Governments can be hostages to fortune, or more accurately, the blind economic forces of fortune hunters. 30 years ago, on a day that became known as Black Monday, speculators broke the pound by shorting the currency and making themselves billions. The markets don't care. Also, Crescent International wrote, British Prime Minister Liz Truss's shoulders are too fragile to carry the weight of a sagging British economy. The pound sterling is sinking vis-a-vis the US dollar and may fall even lower against the greenback. Truss, however, is the architect of her own misfortune. Raw ambition blinded her to the reality that Britain is not only sick, but on its deathbed. Within a month of becoming Prime Minister, and after a grueling leadership contest in which she scrapped past Rishi Sunak, the Indian origin wonderkid of finance, reality has caught up with her. Truss does not have the competence to turn the British economy around. Being a female does not give her any advantage either. Truss dumped her Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng on October 14th, even though he followed her advice on cutting taxes to revive the economy. She essentially shifted blame for her policy to the ousted finance minister.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Dr. Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Well, welcome to today's program. So, on this day in the calendar of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Taleghani passed away. He is believed to be the first Juma prayer leader after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He was a lecturer, a very important lecturer of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, who attracted so many young people to his speeches. He's believed, we can say, to be among the most outstanding intellectuals before and after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Of course, after the Islamic Revolution, he did not live long, maybe 1 or 2 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, this outstanding man passed away. For today's discussion, coincident with this important occasion, that is the death anniversary of Ayatollah Taleghani, we want to talk about Jum'ah prayer itself. What is Jum'ah prayer and how it can establish brotherhood in a Muslim society? Dr. Fakhwani, let's start with you, brother. How do you find the role of Jum'ah prayer in a Muslim land?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin asta'in. First of all, it must be indicated that the Friday or Jum'ah prayer is mentioned in the Holy Quran, and there's a short Quranic surah in this regard.
Okay?
This is an explicit Quranic injunction or Quranic order in this regard. And as we believe that the Holy Quran is the divine text, the divine book intact, okay? There's no doubt regarding its authenticity. At the same time, it must be indicated that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the first dignitary in the Islamic world who established, who introduced and established the Friday prayer. Next, it must be indicated that in several Muslim countries, Muslim nations, people may perform congregational prayer on the day of Friday as a day for, congregation.
That's right.
In the Islamic Republic of Iran, this has been mentioned that, it has various functions, and one of the important functions of the Friday prayer is that people get together and they are informed of the main currents of thought or
That's
main
right.
instructions in the Muslim community.
That's all right. And we know that also maybe some Jumma prayers are held in non-Muslim lands too, but by the Muslim communities. There are some leaders or some imams, we can say, who lead a masjid or a mosque or a community for the Muslims in the Western world, for example, or in the non-Muslim lands. But still, the Jumma prayers and the sermons are held over there. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, how do you find, brother, the role of Jumma prayer in a Muslim land, or spiritually in general?
Yes, of course. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I should mention this important point regarding the Jumma prayer. Is this that according to the Islamic teachings and doctrines, Islam focuses and emphasizes very much on unity among Muslim Ummah or Muslim nation. Because before Islam, you see that there were kind of disagreement, tribal kind of fightings, battles among different clanses and, let's say, tribes.
That's right.
So, yeah, when Islam came, actually, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam tried his best to unite these kind of different groups of people under one kind of,
slogan,
flag, yeah, or slogan
flag,
of Islam,
right,
yeah. So these congregational prayers and also the Jum'ah prayer or Hajj, these kind of rituals that we have in
yes.
Islam, they unite Muslims, they unite Muslim Ummah, Muslim nations. So that's why we see that one of the main objectives of Islam or the prophethood of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was this, that to unite Muslim
yes.
Ummah, to unite first of all the residents of Arab Peninsula, then the other people who converted to Islam. So that's why I think unity and to be united is one of the very important purpose and objective of Islam
that's
and
right.
the prophethood of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
We know that during a week or during, we can say, days and nights of a Muslim land, the people are supposed to attend the congregational or jama'ah prayer in the mosques. But what would be the most important role of Jum'ah prayer now? Because the Muslims usually take part in the congregational prayer. What is the difference between this congregational prayer held on the days Friday with the other days of the week, Dr. Fah?
Initially, it must be indicated that when people get together in mosques, in the neighborhoods, ordinary or, common prayers or common types of salats are held. However,
yes.
ritually speaking, the Friday prayer or Jumma prayer is a bit different from, ordinary type of salat. There are not that major differences. However, in some rituals, they may be different. This
That's
is
right.
one. And another one is that Jumma prayers or Friday prayers are held in very much larger space.
Yes.
More people may attend.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, for example, in Muslim lands and specifically in the Islamic Republic of Iran, we find that on the day of Friday, at noontime,
yes.
okay, local mosques are closed.
Closed, that's right.
And only those places for Jumma prayers, for Friday prayers are open.
Yes.
It has an implication.
Mm-hmm.
The implication is that while throughout the week people are permitted and encouraged to go to the local or neighborhood mosques,
mm-hmm.
on the day of Friday or Jumma, people are expected to get together, larger crowds of people get together.
That's right.
Yes. And more important topics
yes.
will be covered over there.
That's right.
Yes.
And we know it has two sermons, isn't it?
Of course.
Jumma prayer. The first of which I think is about religious content,
yes.
and the second is about the socio-political and the cultural content, not only of the Muslim land, but around the world. And this shows how this prayer is important, I mean, for the Muslims. But let's talk a little bit about the quality of Juma prayer itself, Sheikh Rouhani. How is it held and what should be done in that? And, for example, what are these sermons at all? What details should be tackled by the imam of the Juma prayer?
Yes, of course. One of the responsibilities of the imam Juma or the Juma prayer leader, is this, that to inform the people of the importance of unity, mm-hmm. of the importance of religious beliefs and doctrines and teaching. As you rightly mentioned, in the first sermon, the leader have to actually remind the people of some of the main and important kind of Islamic teachings and yes. doctrines.
Okay.
But in the second sermon, the leader has to actually touch or, let's say, deal with the daily affairs or the important kind of political or social or even sometimes economic kind of issues.
Yes.
It makes no difference whether they are kind of internal kind of issues or sometimes international kind of issues which are related to the Muslims' lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in these second sermons, of course, the leaders and the imams have to actually inform the people or warn the people of some of the very kind of important or challenging kind of issues that the people may face.
That's right.
In modern days.
So you mean the imam of a specific land, for example, Iran, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, or, for example, Kuwait, as a Muslim, has to be concerned about the affairs of the Muslims all across the world, isn't it?
Of course.
And tackle so. Such a question.
Yeah,
you mean in the Juma prayer, we must not be neutral to the cases regarding the Muslim lands, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
Okay.
When, for example, we have Muslims across the globe, when mm-hmm. in some other, for example, areas or countries, they are facing some problems,
yes.
challenging, or they
okay.
are oppressed.
Yes.
So, of course, here it is the responsibility of the imam mm-hmm. to inform the people, and the people should actually concern all these kind of issues
That's
about
right.
the Muslims.
Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Dr. Fakhrouni, as I said, this day, I mean, in the Islamic Republic of Iran's calendar, is the death anniversary of Ayatollah Taleghani. Do you have any live memory from this outstanding man for us and how he attracted the people and the young people to the true message of Islam?
Yes. Regarding the late Ayatollah Taleghani, I do remember his presence. And I met him a couple of times in some, general meetings. He was a very eloquent speaker mm-hmm. and very outspoken.
Yes.
And, he was a very knowledgeable person. And he was regarded as a sincere companion and assistant to the late Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
When the Islamic Revolution of Iran was in gestation, many dignitaries, religio-political dignitaries, were imprisoned.
Yes.
And one of them was the late Ayatollah Taleghani, Sayyid Mahmoud Taleghani.
Yes.
At the same time, I remember that when he delivered his sermons in Friday prayers, he was very outspoken and very critical mm-hmm. of some anti-revolutionary groups and
yes.
their activities.
Yes.
In the beginning, soon after the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, I vividly remember that some people were not able to to oppose the Islamic Revolution of Iran quite openly. Rather, they started to, criticizing this or that person, and from time to time they, started criticizing the whole Islamic movement. Ayatollah Talghani was such a personality who opposed them. For example, there were some leftist groups, pro-Marxist groups, okay? They were very active, and they claimed that they wanted to be on the side of workers or the, for example, working class of society. At the same time, leftists were in power in Afghanistan. And then Ayatollah Talghani made references to the case of Afghanistan and told the leftist groups in Iran that, do you want to change Iran into the next Afghanistan? Look at Afghanistan. There isn't, there isn't safety, there isn't, security, and so on over there. And at the same time, it must be indicated that since the late Ayatollah Talghani spent much time in prison in the time of Shah, and over there, in prison, while he was in the prison, he had direct contacts with the leftists. He was really very knowledgeable,
well-versed
and well-informed of the doctrines. So almost none of them was able to confront him because he had listened to the arguments in prison. And they had nothing to offer to him. And wherever they claimed anything, it was Ayatollah Talghani who answered the claims in his Friday prayer sermons.
That's all right. And unfortunately, as you said, these anti-revolutionary, anti-Islamic groups have martyred so many of the most outstanding Juma imams after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I've got some names over here. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Ghazi Tabatabai, Sayyid Asadullah Madani, Sayyid Abdul Hussein Dasgheib, Muhammad Saduqi, and Atollah Ashafi Isfahani. These were the great men. And we know these were not just, we can't say young with the imams. No, they were old. They were, some of them have reached the level of ijtihad even. They were really, we can't say knowledgeable people who never left the position of leading the Jum'ah prayer and that position. And most of them have been martyred, unfortunately, some of them in the mihrab of the masjid and some of them assassinated by the anti-revolutionary group. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, your final remarks. We got about 2 minutes.
Yes, what I wanted to mention at the end of this session is this, that the imam should be well qualified.
Yes.
And must be a very kind of scholarly kind of figure.
Figure, that's right.
That's why, as you mentioned, the name of these great scholars who were martyred by the oppositions. So, of course, because of their great influence on the people, so the leftists feared a lot these great scholars. That's why they killed them and they were martyred by them. So I think this it shows the great role of Jum'ah prayer and also the Jum'ah prayer leaders in the society and now in nowadays lives. This is what should be taken into consideration while talking about Jum'ah prayer.
And we hope that Jum'ah prayer and the congregation of Jum'ah prayer finds its true place in all Muslim lands, to be concerned with the affairs of the Muslim society, inshallah establishing a kind of brotherhood and unity, not only among the Muslims of a specific land, but all the people across the world. This is truly a nice podium in order to speak about the unity and brotherhood for all the Muslims across the world, inshallah. Thank you much, Sheikh Tafakh Rouhani and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the role of Jum'ah prayer in establishing brotherhood and unity among the Muslims. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we examine Western efforts to create turmoil, instability, and civil war in Iran, as well as Western efforts to disintegrate and break up the Islamic Republic. Please stay with us. One of the principal objectives of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has been to bring about the collapse of the Islamic Republic and the disintegration of Islamic Iran. This has been their main objective since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February of 1979. They have used every opportunity to strike a blow at Iran. Their hostility knows no bounds. This amount of hostility, plots and schemes directed at a popular democratic nation is certainly rare, if not unprecedented. The soft war being waged against Iran by mainstream Western media, the media campaign against Iran by American and British media, are all part of Western efforts during the past 43 years to stifle the Islamic Republic. The current unrest and rioting in Iran can also be seen through this perspective. The Zionist regime of Israel and some backward reactionary Arab regimes of the region have also tried to fuel the unrest in Iran. When Islamic Iran was just a fledgling state back in 1979, separatist and secessionist groups became active, particularly in the border regions of the country, in provinces such as Kurdistan, Khuzestan, and Azerbaijan. The terror groups used guns against the people, ironically, in the name of the people. This separatist sedition was still playing out when the not-so-clever former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, egged on by both the West and the East, decided to invade Iran militarily. The Ba'athist army crossed Iran's southern and western borders, initiating a full military invasion, and somewhat naively, they expected to push all the way to the capital, Tehran, in a matter of days. But unexpectedly for the Ba'athists, they encountered a massive and determined Iranian resistance by the Iranian people. 8 years of war followed, and a much more powerful and modern Iran emerged after the fighting. In the years following the war, Iran made enormous progress in many areas of science and technology, including aerospace technology, peaceful civilian nuclear technology, biotechnology and stem cell research, microelectronics and nanotechnology. Iran also made huge strides in development of military hardware and weapon systems, so much so that we became a regional power in West Asia and no one even dared to think about attacking us. Surprisingly, all this progress was made in the years following the 8-year imposed war, when Western countries, led by the United States of America, slapped the most stringent of sanctions and boycotts against Islamic Iran. former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the United States from the landmark nuclear accord with Iran in May of 2018, to the surprise of everyone. Donald Trump didn't like the agreement because it was reached by his predecessor, Barack Obama, and he decided to follow a policy of maximum sanctions and maximum pressure against Tehran. This was tantamount to economic terrorism against the Islamic Republic. Just 3 years later, at the end of his presidency, Donald Trump was forced to acknowledge that his policy of maximum sanctions had been a failure and had not achieved any of its objectives. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, commented on this policy of maximum sanctions by saying, "They pulled out all the stops. They did everything they could to break the resistance and the will of the Iranian people. They used economic pressure and cultural assault. Whenever a country resists the hegemonic powers, they try to make it passive and inactive. The biggest mistake one can make against the enemy is to be passive and inactive. This is a huge mistake. We must never regard the enemy as weak or unworthy. We must always regard the enemy as dangerous. We must always be prepared to confront the enemy, be vigilant and alert, and we must never be afraid of the enemy. We must not be intimidated by it. Remember, the biggest mistake is to be inactive and passive vis-a-vis the enemy." Despite the huge economic pressure, the Iranian nation has succeeded in neutralizing and bypassing many of the unjust sanctions imposed against us. But this did not signify an end to the hostilities against Islamic Iran by United States and its European allies. Their aim is to split Iranian society, open up a chasm between young Iranians and the government, pit Iranians against one another. They don't want just regime change in Tehran, they want to create a civil war inside Iran and disintegrate the country, splitting it into several regions. In the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, "The US is not just against the Islamic Republic, it is also against a strong, independent Iran. They are after the Iran of the Pahlavi era. Iran was to them a milking cow. The Shah submitted to their orders, and when in quandary, he often asked to see the US ambassador or the British ambassador to ascertain what course of action he should take. How can the Iranian nation tolerate this shame? This is what the enemies want. They are opposed to an independent and a powerful Iran." The leader has also commented on the double standards of the United States and the West with regards to the recent riots in Iran. He said, "Many riots take place in the world. Every now and then, there are large riots in Europe, especially in France and in Paris. But has the US President or the US House of Representatives ever supported the rioters and issued a statement? Is there any record of them sending a message saying that we stand with the demonstrators in France? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism and the US client regimes, such as some regional governments like Saudi Arabia, supporting rioters in those countries? But such support against the Islamic Republic of Iran has happened repeatedly. There is no doubt that the enemies of the Islamic Republic use every opportunity and every means at their disposal to strike a blow against Iran. They are currently using social media networks to wage an extensive media campaign, a fully-fledged media war against Iran. They can use a variety of issues, such as the sad death of a young girl, to initiate turmoil and rioting within the country." There is dissatisfaction within Iran with regards to the government's performance and the current economic situation of the country. What is certain is that peoples of many other countries are also dissatisfied with the performance of their governments. For example, in many European countries we see industrial action, we see demonstrations and protests in response to rising food and fuel prices, rising inflation and the cost of living crisis. But in none of those European countries do we see active support from outside of the country for the demonstrators, for those who engage in rioting, and we don't see interference in the internal affairs of those countries by the United States and Canada. The United States, Canada, and some European countries are more Catholic than the Pope. They pretend to care about the Iranian people, even more so than the Iranian government, and they criticize the Iranian security forces for attempting to establish order and peace in the country. They openly interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic and stoke tensions within the country. But their own dreadful human rights record and long-running persecution and genocide of indigenous peoples makes them particularly unsuitable for lecturing on this issue. For example, the recent grim discovery of a mass grave containing the remains of hundreds of indigenous Canadian children, Canada's First Nation, who were forcibly taken away from their families and taken to special schools where they were mistreated and persecuted. Or the centuries-long persecution and killing of Native Americans in the United States. Given this background, how on earth can they claim the moral high ground? Under these circumstances, the Canadian Prime Minister threatens Iran with sanctions, using the unfortunate death of a young Iranian woman as a pretext. Social media sites are currently doing all they can to create turmoil and crisis in Iran. Western governments are making instrumental use of these social media sites to spread disinformation, prevarication, and lies in Iran. These particularly target young Iranians. No doubt, the Iranian nation, particularly the younger generation, will overcome the current difficulties and will navigate their way through the crisis which has been created by the West. No doubt, the Islamic Republic of Iran will maintain its independence, will maintain its strength and authority, and will emerge with flying colours from this difficult period.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.